Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 19th of July. Last week I was talking about an underwater monument, the 40 stone crosses off the coast of the Canary Islands, which commemorate Blessed Ignacio de Azevedo and his 39 companions. People go there to dive down to it, and just possibly in some of their minds it awakens a sense of place. The importance of places in terms of commemoration and also understanding, the importance of uniting yourself to a place by going to it. At the end of this week, Saturday the 25th, the Feast of St. James the Apostle, is about the same theme of place, but it doesn't whisper it, it proclaims it. It strides through the centuries, proclaiming the value and virtue of pilgrimage. James and John were the sons of Zebedee. They were fishermen. They got the nickname Sons of Thunder, perhaps because of their own personalities, or perhaps because their pushy mother was such a definite figure. She was the one who insisted that they should be given the highest places in the kingdom of heaven. James was one of the witnesses of the Transfiguration. He slept through most of the agony in the garden. He was the first of the apostles to be martyred, being beheaded by King Herod Agrippa to please the Jewish opponents of Christianity. He was buried in Jerusalem, and that is all we officially know about him. In the 9th century we learn that the relics of St. James were in Spain. No one is certain exactly when or how they arrived there, but once the relics were there, the shrine of St. James at Compostela in Galicia grew in importance until it became the greatest pilgrimage centre in Western Europe. In every country there are churches of St. James tied up somehow with the pilgrimage. In Paris, the Tour Saint-Jacques marks the start of the route, and the Rue Saint-Jacques points straight towards Compostela. England, being an island, is practical in its own way. All over the country there are pilgrim routes, if you look for them. They don't point directly towards Compostela, they point towards the port you would go to take a ship to get there. Since the Middle Ages didn't have planes and trains, we think of them as being a rather static time. But what the Middle Ages did have, and we don't, is time, an enormous amount of it. Time and freedom, and so it was a great time of pilgrimage. Surprising numbers of people went on short ones or long ones, rich and poor, men and women. Canterbury gives us Chaucer and the Canterbury Tales. Jerusalem gives us the maddening Norfolk woman Marjorie Kemp, who spent a couple of years going there and getting back and wrote a book about it, which is a monument of medieval English literature and a wonderfully honest and charming work. On her way home from Jerusalem, arriving at Venice, she tells us her companions had had enough of her. They said they would not go any further with her for £100. Marjorie did go to Compostela as well, and today more and more people are going on the pilgrimage of St. James each year, either the whole route or at least some part of it. Some people make an explicitly Christian thing out of it, some don't, but I don't think God minds. Learn to serve me first, God says, and afterwards you will come to understand who it is you have been serving. It's rather a New Testament week this week, because Wednesday the 22nd is the Feast of St. Mary Magdalene. There are too many women called Mary in the Gospels. It must have been an alarmingly popular name. More than that, there are also quite a few women who are important in the Gospel story but have no name. The evangelists were busy making a coherent narrative of the most important story in the history of the world, and they didn't have time or space to interrupt it by putting footnotes into it. When the woman breaks the jar of ointment to anoint Jesus with it, you can't interrupt. Stop. Go off. Ask people. Do your research. Just so that you can proudly and irrelevant say for certain what the name of the woman was. We, the readers, like to know things, and so we try to tie together some of the loose ends the evangelists didn't have time or patience for. In the West, at the height of the interest in fitting things together, there was a tradition that Mary of Magdala was the same person as Mary the sister of Martha and Lazarus of Bethany, and also the woman who was a sinner who washed Jesus' feet with her tears. The Eastern Church never went this far, neither did the Benedictines. Lots of lovely spirituality of penitence came out of this identification of the Magdalene, but that doesn't make it true. Looking back, the sources seem to come from a 6th century sermon here, some 13th century pious ideas there. All in all, nowadays everyone is sure that St. Mary Magdalene is not the woman who was a sinner, and not Mary of Bethany. We are so sure that we have turned the feast of St. Martha in a week's time into the feast of Saints Martha, Mary, and Lazarus, because we can be sure that we won't be celebrating the same woman twice. That's the trouble with having such a historically based religion as Catholicism. There are things it would be really lovely to believe, but we're still not allowed to believe them if they don't fit the data. And after all that, St. Mary Magdalene herself still remains. She is still a person. Stripped of all the stories we mistakenly gave her, she was still present at the crucifixion. Jesus still revealed himself to her at the resurrection, and she still carried the news back to the apostles, which sent Peter and John running to see what had happened. In that sense, she is one of the most important women in the whole story. The preface of the Mass of her feast gives her the title Apostle to the Apostles. Here is another thing about Mary Magdalene. We think of Jesus as being mostly surrounded by the poor, sent to the poor. Actually, comfortably fed priests spend quite a bit of time implying that if we have somewhere to live, and if we are trying to feed our families, we are doing something that isn't quite right. But look at Mary Magdalene. Mary of Magdala. She was clearly a woman of some importance, some standing. Pay attention to what those women were actually doing, whom Luke calls women who accompanied him from Galilee. They weren't a swooning mass of unwashed groupies in camper vans. The missionary journey from the beginning of the story to the end had to be travelled the way all life has to be travelled, one day at a time. Each day, supplies, laundry, hygiene, it all has to be done. Someone has to do it. Someone has to have the resources to make it possible and the force of personality to organize it and make it happen. We can take St. Mary Magdalene as a prototype of the rich ladies throughout history who have seen not only the big picture, but the brushstrokes that were needed to paint that picture. They didn't just talk about being good. They saw all the way down to the day-by-day details of doing it, the way women have to, and did whatever was necessary to make sure that that good was done. Mary Magdalene is important in a third way. Not only the apostle to the apostles. Not only the organizer of the commissariat of the wandering disciples. But the woman whom Jesus freed of 7 devils. If you say you believe in devils nowadays, most people laugh at you. You probably laugh at yourself. That doesn't make them not be. When Jesus goes round casting out devils in the gospel, it's very often the most important thing he does, more important than bodily healing. So believe it. Don't say, "It's all the olden days and people were stupid back then," because thinking that other people are stupid is the real stupidity. What you are really saying, if you say that, is that you don't want to think about evil properly. Let's make a little sketch of what a devil is. A devil is something that does you harm. It is something inside you that seems to be part of you, but isn't really. Indeed, the day when you decide definitely that the evil in you is not the real you is the day your freedom begins. Finally, a devil is a kind of evil which to some degree has a certain kind of autonomy. Here's an example. I don't know if it'll ring a bell for you, but let's try. There was a time when I was overwhelmed with work and stress but was also going regularly once a week to an exercise studio run by a genius. I remember saying to myself, walking there, "Life is absolutely pointless, and in 2 hours I'll be thinking exactly the opposite." As the time for my weekly visit approached, excuses would bubble up out of nowhere and demand my attention. "This or that thing needs doing urgently, so I can't go. Or I'm too tired. Or too distracted. Or I've left my trainers behind." I hope these excuses sound ridiculous to you, because ridiculous is what they were. They had no meaning in themselves. They were symptoms. What was really going on was this. I was about to do something that would do serious harm to my stress and depression. Quite possibly it would destroy it. And the stress and depression knew this, and it was protecting itself by whispering those excuses to me. This evil was something inside me that had a rudimentary personality. It had autonomy and an urge to survive, which is to say, a devil. Parenthetically, if the story does ring a bell for you, let me make a suggestion. Tell yourself loudly that the gym, or whatever else it is that does you good, is an unpleasant duty, which will do you no good at all, and make life even more pointless. Say it convincingly enough, and your devil will believe you, and therefore encourage you to do it, and it will still do you good. Devils are malicious, but mostly not very intelligent. Devils can be big or they can be little. They can be of crushing power or just a minor nuisance. Jesus has power over them even now, but he is like a doctor in that he can't do anything to heal you unless you ask. Start by saying about the evil inside you, "This is not me." With a simple weak little devil, that will make you able to ask for help. If the devil is more powerful, you won't be able to form the intention to be rid of the thing, but you can be like the man in the gospel who could do nothing except repeat over and over again, "God be merciful to me, a sinner." The thing never to say is, "That is just what I'm into, it's just the way I am." As long as you can say about your devils, "This is not me," in the long run you will be saved. Even if you are being compelled now to do what you do not want to do, and you don't know how to stop, as long as deep down there is a will that does not consent to the evil, in the long run you are safe. God's power is perfected in weakness. Coming back to Mary Magdalene and her devils, whatever they may have been, she is a reminder that people in this life can go through the most terrible episodes of being besieged by evil, inhabited by it, and yet be rescued from it. Looking at that kind of event afterwards, sometimes you want to say two almost opposite things at once. You say, "This should never have happened," but you also say, "It is good that it did happen." That's because the people who have been through the great persecution have about them the glow of God's grace that got them through it and out of it. It's like the glow of Moses' face when he had just been talking face to face with God. Mary Magdalene could well have looked like that. Back to pilgrimage. Indeed, back to the pilgrimage to the shrine of St. James at Compostela, because Thursday's saint went on exactly this pilgrimage. She is St. Bridget of Sweden. Together with St. Benedict, she is one of the patron saints of Europe. I knew nothing at all about St. Bridget before I sat down to write this. Perhaps Sweden is beyond the range of our cultural radar, but most ignorance is just laziness. Bridget was born in 1303. She came from a landowning family, and her father was the governor of a province. She married a suitably noble husband at the age of 13. Bridget's husband was a good and pious man. They had 8 children, most of whom survived into adulthood. When she was almost 40, she made the pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela, which gives us that connection with St. James. Her pilgrimage took some years. On their way home, her husband fell ill, and he died soon after they got back. At this point, Bridget gave herself entirely to the things of God. She prayed and meditated. She was given visions, which were published and were much read all across Europe. She founded a new religious congregation, the Bridgetines, one of whose outstanding qualities was that the communities took the form of double monasteries, a kind of Siamese twin, if you like. There was one wing for women and another for men, with the church in the middle shared between them. Those monasteries may be one of the reasons why we now like to forget Bridget. We are so convinced now that women are poor, weak creatures, oppressed and needing to be liberated from their oppression. We know it. Bridget didn't know any of this. Her double monasteries were under the rule of an abbess who bore the title of the Sovereign. All land was owned in the Sovereign's name. All contracts were signed by her. The monks existed to provide services to the nuns, as confessors, as priests to serve mass for them. This arrangement of men serving the needs of women has excellent scriptural justification. Remember that almost the last words Jesus spoke before he died were, "Son, behold your mother." And so the sons in the Bridgetine monastery existed to look after and obey and respect their mothers. The Bridgetine order had great success. King Henry V laid the foundation stone of the Bridgetine monastery of Sion House on the River Thames just upstream of London. King Henry VIII was a benefactor of the monastery before he changed his policy and destroyed everything. Later, after he had expelled the monks and nuns, the monastery had a new use. He imprisoned one of his wives there for a while before executing her. A typical Bridgetine monastery had 60 nuns, 13 priests, and 4 deacons, with 8 lay brothers as servants. The total number of people added up to 85, in other words, 72 plus 13. That corresponded to the 72 disciples sent out by Jesus, plus the 13 apostles. It was 13 apostles, not because Bridget was counting both Judas Iscariot and Matthias, but because she was counting St. Paul. The Middle Ages absolutely loved numbers and arithmetic, and it is rather charming to see this coming out in St. Bridget's rule. As well as founding a monastic order, Bridget composed a set of 15 prayers in honour of Christ in his Passion. There are various ways of using them. On high penitential days, you might say them every hour from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Stretching across the year, you might say one a day. These prayers became tremendously popular, especially as coming from the mind of such a renowned visionary. People love visions and anything arcane and mystical. Gradually, more and more so-called promises of God were attached to the recitation of these prayers, until in the end they weren't really prayers any more, but magical incantations that you'd recite in the same way that you might wear a lucky Cornish pixie dangling from your wrist. If I tell you that one promise was guaranteed paradise for whichever 15 members of your family you choose, you will get the kind of idea. This all had to be stamped out hard, and in the 1950s it was forbidden to publish any book that offered such promises. But the prayers themselves remain good prayers. They are all collected together into the second reading in the Office of Readings on Bridget's feast on Thursday. Bridget did not stop after founding a monastic order. She wanted to change the world, so she travelled to Rome, where the centre of the world was. At the time, because of international turbulence, the popes had fled to exile in Avignon in France and had been there some considerable time. Bridget told Pope Urban V to come back from Avignon to Rome, which he did. I say told because, from what we hear of Bridget, it is difficult to imagine her asking for anything. When Urban's position in Rome turned out untenable and he wanted to go back to France, Bridget told him he would die if he did. He did go back, and he did die. Bridget remained in Rome and continued to do good with her pious and charitable works until she herself died in 1373 at the age of 70. As a matter of history, the popes did return to Rome for good 3 years later. Our modern times shed one curious sidelight on the story of Bridget. You may have come to think of Wikipedia as randomly unreliable, because it is, but it is absolutely reliable on one thing. It represents the unanimous trend of enlightened, progressive opinion. And at the end of its Bridget of Sweden article, there's a list of the various ways in which Bridget was, for enlightened, progressive opinion, not such a good thing after all. You can summarise it like this. Bridget is severely disapproved of for being rude in the way she told people off when they were not doing right. She behaved as if she was right and they were wrong. This says very little about Bridget, of course, but a lot about us. To be approved of, a holy woman needs to be a victim. A wet, weak and weeping nun nobody has any trouble with. A forthright woman who knows what is right and says so is unnatural. The present age is far too advanced to use actual words like unfeminine or unladylike, but it has a deep belief in that exact concept. You may remember that Mother Teresa also attracted rage at her lack of feminine weakness. If these women so enrage our modern world, it is evident that we need many more of them. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.